This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Shattered. Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. Introduction. When we first began reporting for this book in late 2014, Hillary Clinton was the candidate to beat for the presidency. Her resume, First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State, was unassailable. At her peak in the last job, two-thirds of Americans had approved of her performance. More important, she had spent a great deal of time and energy trying to correct the flaws of her 2008 Democratic primary loss to Barack Obama. And most political analysts believed that Democrats, coming off his consecutive victories, had two powerful advantages in presidential elections: a mortal lock on states that provided 242 of the 270 electoral votes needed to win the White House, and a superior handle on the mechanics of turning out voters. Hillary and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, had been preparing for this bid for 6 years. They had rewarded friends and punished disloyal Democrats after the 2008 race. Bill had raised money for Obama and delivered a rousing endorsement of the sitting president at the 2012 Democratic National Convention, a move that helped seal the Obama-Clinton bond. He had campaigned in Democratic primaries against candidates who the Clintons felt had betrayed Hillary in 2008. Once she was out of government, Hillary herself had hit the hustings for Democratic Senate candidates in the 2014 midterm elections. And in 2013 and 2014, a super PAC run and funded by her allies had raised millions of dollars and collected hundreds of thousands of names of potential supporters. They were ready for Hillary. Having written the 2014 book, HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton, we were convinced that she was indeed running, and that no other Democrat could defeat her in the primary. The same conclusion that kept most serious Democrats from running against her. Moreover, as party political figures told us, the fear of reprisal meant that there was a cost for Democrats who didn't jump on her bandwagon. Some, like Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, endorsed her long before she committed to a run. In short, Hillary had every imaginable institutional advantage in winning the Democratic nomination. As David Plouffe, the mastermind behind Obama's 2008 victory, put it in a private conversation in September 2014, she's bulletproof. Of course, there were reasons to think that she wouldn't just waltz into the White House. It's hard for a party to win three consecutive presidential elections. The rise of the Tea Party and other anti-institutional forces in both parties had wreaked havoc on the establishment since Obama's first election. And Hillary had always been a polarizing figure in American politics, particularly when she was a candidate. But heading into our reporting, we thought there was a pretty good chance that we would be writing the inside story of Hillary shattering what she had called the highest, hardest glass ceiling. We were surprised then, when Clinton World sources started telling us in 2015 that Hillary was still struggling to articulate her motivation for seeking the presidency. And we were taken aback by how much infighting was going on below the surface of her campaign, at a time when, unlike 2008, very little of it had spilled into the press. In so many ways, and as some of our sources acknowledged, Hillary was fighting the last war. She did that with varying degrees of success. But the variable she couldn't change was the candidate. Over the course of a year and a half, in interviews with more than 100 sources, we started to piece together a picture that was starkly at odds with the narrative the campaign and the media were portraying publicly. Hillary's campaign was so spirit-crushing that her aides eventually shorthanded the feeling of impending doom with a simple mantra, "We're not allowed to have nice things." Every time it looked like she had hit her stride in the race, a new obstacle appeared in her path. And yet, there were few moments between her kickoff rally and the closing of the first polls on election day when she wasn't the favorite. So it wasn't until the results came in that all of our reporting finally made sense. That the foreboding signs along the way had been pointing in the right direction, even when they were at odds with the available data. We made one decision early on in our process that proved crucial in allowing us access to key players, even at times when most of the media were walled off from Hillary and her senior staff. We agreed to conduct all of our interviews on background, which provided anonymity to our sources. That gave them an extra sense of security on the off chance that we broke a vow that we observed throughout our reporting. None of the material would appear before the election. We spoke to nearly everyone we asked to interview, up and down the ranks of the campaign, and many of them talked to us during pivotal periods of the race. Without these guarantees, which protected our sources inside and outside the campaign from the possible reprisal of the next president, many of them would not have talked with us at all. Others would have been much less candid. The trade-offs enabled us to get an extraordinary look at the last tumultuous chapter of the Clinton era. In that final hurrah, Hillary broke one glass ceiling, becoming the first female nominee of a major political party, and forever put to rest the question of whether a woman could be seen as commander-in-chief. She collected nearly 65.9 million votes, more than any Republican nominee in American history, just 64,822 fewer than Barack Obama in 2012, and almost 3 million more than Donald Trump. And she did that while facing a set of trials and tribulations unlike any other in American campaign history. A partisan congressional investigation, a primary opponent who attacked her character, a rogue FBI director, the rank misogyny of her Republican rival, a media that scrutinized her every move while failing to get that Republican rival to turn over his tax returns, and even a Kremlin-based campaign to defeat her. In the end, though, this was a winnable race for Hillary. Her own missteps, from setting up a controversial private email server and giving speeches to Goldman Sachs, to failing to convince voters that she was with them and turning her eyes away from working-class whites, gave Donald Trump the opportunity he needed to win. This is the story of how it all unraveled again for Hillary. We expect that it will generate a feeling of righteousness and perhaps a touch of sympathy in those of you who don't like her. For many of Hillary's millions of supporters, we know that it will leave you feeling shattered all over again. Chapter 1. Or I Wouldn't Have Run. Hillary Clinton had a new rendezvous with destiny on her mind. Her motorcade sped toward Roosevelt Island on the morning of June 13, 2015. In a little more than an hour, she would officially kick off what she hoped would be a trailblazing, glass-ceiling-shattering campaign for the presidency. For most of the previous 48 hours, she had been trying to give a feel of historic importance to her first major address. It just wasn't there yet. She picked up the phone and called her chief speechwriter, Dan Schwerin. After 2 days of trading drafts with Hillary, after waiting through the delay of a power outage at her Chappaqua, New York home, the bearded 32-year-old with a signature chestnut pompadour was just about to board the tram connecting Manhattan to the East River Island. He had stayed up all night, pulling together tweaks to the 3:30 a.m. version of the speech, and he looked hungover. Now, battling exhaustion and the sweltering heat, Schwerin pulled out his laptop one more time and sat down on the platform so that Hillary could dictate her final edits. The key passage of the speech was an explanation of why she was running for president. To make our economy work for you and for every American. In the middle of that run, about how she would do it and who she would fight for, Hillary wanted to connect herself and her campaign to Franklin Roosevelt, the president who defined the aspirations of the Democratic Party and much of the nation for generations. "Here on Roosevelt Island," she said to Schwerin, "I believe we have a continuing rendezvous with destiny." He tapped the echo of FDR's 1936 Democratic Convention speech into his computer at 11 a.m. and took the next cable car to the island. Few would notice the last-minute change. The cluttered speech had become a testament to the aimlessness and passive-aggressive infighting that plagued the early stages of Hillary's campaign. Hillary had tried to put together a team this time that would feature far less internal drama than her failed 2008 bid. Back then, big personalities had clashed openly, aired dirty laundry and strategy details in the press, and sometimes pursued their own goals at the expense of hers. In the intervening years, she'd assigned a lot of the blame for her loss to the warring inside her campaign. But that was hardly the only ailment from 2008 that she hoped to remedy. She hadn't sold a vision for the country. She'd run away from being a woman, instead of leaning into the unique aspect of her political story. To manage her campaign, she'd tapped a friend rather than the top pro. She'd let her husband run wild on the trail, and she had failed to take advantage of the latest technology to build a movement of grassroots supporters and donors. From a strategic standpoint, she'd dumped millions of dollars into Iowa, the first in the nation caucus, even though that only elevated the importance of her devastating third-place finish there. She'd gone on the attack against a better-liked rival whose platform more closely mirrored the values of the party's base, creating a boomerang effect on her personal standing. Perhaps worst of all, she'd obsessed over winning the popular vote in big states rather than targeting the all-important delegates and superdelegates whose votes at the Democratic Convention determined the party's nominee. But the idea burned into her mind as much as anything else was that she had lost because she'd hired people who put their own interests above getting her elected. The absence of palace intrigue on her opponent's side, the No Drama Obama campaign, was the kind of purpose-driven loyalty she pined for. Over the next 7 years, Hillary would rebuild her political organization while working at the State Department and the Clinton Foundation, punish those who had been disloyal to her, and prepare herself to mount a second bid for the most powerful job on the planet. When she conceded to Obama in 2008, she'd thanked voters for putting 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling of the presidency. By the time she finished the 2016 campaign, she believed, that glass ceiling would lay shattered beneath her feet. And yet, what Hillary couldn't quite see is that no matter how she recast the supporting roles in this production or emphasized different parts of the script, the main character hadn't changed. Huddled around a white table in the conference room of the Clintons' Midtown Manhattan personal office in the early spring of 2015, months before she would go to Roosevelt Island to deliver her first major address, the first hires of Hillary's worst-kept secret campaign outlined a plan to fly her to Iowa. They had pegged the Hawkeye State, where caucus-goers had doomed her first bid for the Oval Office, as the best spot for her kickoff speech. But Hillary didn't like what she was hearing. She didn't want to go big, at least not yet, and she didn't want the first major address of what could be a history-making campaign to be set against a minimalistic backdrop like some farmer's back porch. to the chagrin of campaign manager Robbie Mook, who would have to build a billion-dollar apparatus, Hillary had been dragging her feet about making things official. She understood that her team needed to start raising funds, hire more staff, and begin recruiting volunteers. But she also knew she had to be fully prepared for this battle. And she just wasn't ready. Mook, clean-cut with close-cropped brown hair and lively hazel eyes, was antsy. At one point, there was even discussion of his starring in a campaign-launching video announcing the formation of an exploratory committee. But Hillary was wary of repeating some of the major mistakes of her 2008 bid. She had rushed into her announcement that year to compete with Obama, and she had made it all about her. "I'm in it to win," she'd said in her campaign opening video. This time she wanted to show she was listening to voters, talking with them one-on-one or in small groups and in informal settings, all with the knowledge that everything she did would be dutifully reported by a press corps hungry for nuggets from the trail. "We've come so far under President Obama, but we have so many problems," she told her advisors. "I want to make sure I'm the right person." Given that everyone in the room had ostensibly been hired to run her campaign, and that some of them had been in on earlier discussions about the timing and logistics of her launch, no one believed she was really so ambivalent. But sitting by a bank of three windows, 27 floors above the bustle of 7th Avenue, Hillary rendered a clear verdict on the Iowa kickoff plan. No. She would go to Iowa in April, she said, but not to deliver a launch speech, and not in a private jet. She would drive in a van and try to find people along the way who weren't expecting to run into her. After a quarter of a century locked inside the political bubble of the New York to Washington stretch of the Acela Corridor, Hillary was eager to find out what people thought about the state of the country. And about her. She didn't want to officially kick off the campaign until she'd had a chance to repeat what she'd done when she first ran for a New York Senate seat, gather information from voters. She wanted to do that before giving a big speech and having a big event and saying, "I have all this figured out," said one aide. We didn't have it all figured out. Her big opening address would come at a location with more historic consequence. But for now, a soft launch could go forward, an upbeat video followed by the road trip. The time would come for her to speak into the winds of history. But as much as she knew Iowa wasn't the place, she also knew that her moment hadn't yet come. She'd been off the political battlefield for 7 years. As Secretary of State, she'd worked to win concessions in diplomatic back rooms across the world, but she didn't have to worry about securing millions of votes. Barack Obama had been elected president, and the Tea Party had risen in the time since she'd last been on the campaign trail as a candidate. The nation's political bearings had shifted. And if her 2014 book tour had taught her anything, it was that she was rusty as hell. Talking to voters, she hoped, would help her sharpen her political skills and develop her vision for the country's future. Obama had been relentlessly superb at telling voters why he was running for president and giving them a window into how he would govern. He was confident, cocky even, about his vision. Hillary, a modest, Midwestern Methodist with a love of minutiae, was unshakably focused on the trees rather than the forest. This campaign would test the A student's ability to adapt, to subordinate her nature to her need to win. In preparing to campaign again, she studied Obama's February 2007 launch speech in Springfield, the one he delivered on the steps of the old state capitol, the one that connected him with fellow Illinois state legislator Abraham Lincoln, who had freed the slaves in an act that set the first stone on Obama's improbable path to the presidency. She kept hearkening back to Obama in Springfield, said one of Hillary's top advisors. She had gone back to read that speech and how important it was for people as a marker of what he would do in the presidency. She viewed it as an important kind of roadmap for her governing principles and her actual plans to be president. In her mind, the first landmark address of what she hoped and believed would be a historic campaign couldn't be about the politics of the moment, about tipping a few Iowa caucus-goers in her direction. It had to be about how she could reshape the nation from the Oval Office. For Hillary, a wonk in the best and worst senses of the word, that meant devising her policy agenda before she ever stepped to the podium. Most politicians understand that voters are looking for big, bold principles, easy-to-grasp concepts, and that the details can be filled in to fit them. For Hillary, policy is vision, and she would try to build a platform, program by program, into a blueprint for the country. This prospect was actually a relief. It was more comfortable for her to sit in four-hour meetings at the conference table with her policy chief, the reedy, whip-smart Jake Sullivan, than to define herself by a small set of guiding principles and shape her policy ideas to fit them. Hillary adored the 38-year-old Sullivan, enough to joke publicly about her confidence that he would someday be president of the United States. He had served Hillary as deputy chief of staff at State, a position from which he gradually vacuumed up all or parts of the jobs of several senior colleagues. Hillary appreciated both his competence and his ambition. His instincts on policy and politics matched hers. So she turned to him to run what she thought was the most important part of the campaign, the substance. That's what bonded Hillary to her young protege. They geeked out over policy, and it's what she wanted at the heart of her first address to the voting public. This is her deeply held thing. Elections should be about policy, said one senior Hillary advisor. There's a textbook quality to her articulation of things. That would make every step of narrative building its own form of excruciating drudgery. But it would soon seem like a minor nuisance for a campaign that was miserable even before it started. In early March, just as she was planning to reintroduce herself to a nation that felt it knew her all too well with a video announcement of her campaign, the New York Times reported that Hillary had used an email address tied to a personal server at her family home in Chappaqua to conduct official State Department business. The email story would bedevil her straight through Election Day, robbing her of the ability to create a positive narrative for her candidacy and, as one top advisor put it, returning to her like a cold sore. You never know when it's going to pop up, this advisor said. You think you're over it, and then it pops up again. At the time, it was impossible to know how long the email story would last and just how badly it would damage the campaign. Do you have any idea of the depth of this story? Campaign Chairman John Podesta asked Mook when it broke. Nope, Mook replied. We brought up the existence of emails in research this summer, but were told that everything was taken care of. That's reassuring, Podesta shot back. Yikes. Yeah, Mook responded. This is going to be an interesting campaign. I'm in this Zen place now where I'm focusing on the website and telling myself this is all background noise. For those who couldn't bury their heads, praying for divine intervention was an attractive alternative. I'm lighting candles in church all the time, pollster John Anzalone told Mook. When the email story first hit, Hillary's aides were still trying to get a feel for one another. The crisis acted as a catalyst for infighting. Publicly, she was running a no-drama campaign, But behind the scenes, Hillary's brain trust broke into tribes. The Mook Mafia, led by Mook, Marlon Marshall, his top lieutenant, Elon Kriegel, the data analytics chief, and Oren Schur, the paid media director. The State Crew, led on the inside by Huma Abedin, the vice chairwoman, Jake Sullivan, Nick Merrill, the traveling press secretary, and Dan Schwerin, the chief speechwriter, with longtime Clinton advisors Cheryl Mills and Philippe Raines invisibly guiding Hillary behind the scenes. The consultants, led by Joel Benenson, the chief strategist, Jim Margolis, the ad maker, and Mandy Grunwald, the longtime Clinton message maven. The communications shop, led by Jennifer Palmieri, the communications director, Christina Shockey, her deputy, and Christina Reynolds, the research director, who had worked with Palmieri on the John Edwards campaign. At the start, Podesta was seen as a high-level troubleshooter. Short, wiry, and in his mid-60s, the marathon-running former top aide to Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had deep ties to every power center in the Democratic Party. He was supposed to play an adult-in-the-room role on the campaign, coordinating with Bill's office, the White House, Democratic interest groups, and major donors. In theory, Podesta would provide air cover in Clinton world, lessening the burden on Mook and allowing the campaign manager to focus on executing. But even as Podesta provided guidance to Mook, the two clashed stylistically from the outset. "John is very intuitive and from the gut," explained one senior Hillary aide, "and Robbie requires a lot of information." As Podesta would come to learn, Mook guarded that information jealously to maintain his own power. Podesta was also wary of at least one member of Hillary's State Crew. When the email scandal first burst into the open, Philippe Raines, who had a rare direct line to the boss after running her media operations at the State Department and in the Senate, went to war with Jennifer Palmieri, the new communications director for the campaign, over how to respond. Raines, highly obsessive, ultra-loyal to Hillary, and possessed of an acid tongue, pointed his finger at Palmieri when Hillary complained that deliberations about the timing of her first public remarks on the email server were leaking to the media. "This is creating trust problems on her end," Raines wrote to the campaign's top officials, establishing for everyone that he had a closer relationship with Hillary than her new communications chief. Palmieri fired back to the group, insisting that she wasn't the source of leaks. "I am telling you right now that if there is any hint of trust issues with me, I am not taking this job," she wrote. Podesta replied just to her. "Chill," he wrote, before taking a shot at Raines. "Remember, the source of the email got us in this hot mess." He told another friend that Raines was the only person about whom you're torn between patting him on the back and trying to get him committed to Bellevue. It all came to a head as the campaign debated plans to hold a news conference and give a one-on-one interview to NBC's Andrea Mitchell. On the night of March 8, 2015, Raines spoke to Hillary, who wasn't yet sold on her team's pitch. The next day, aides' bickering continued over a leak that Mitchell would get an interview and that there might be an impending press conference. "This has gone too far," Raines wrote to Podesta, who opened the thread up to Mills and Hillary. "Philippe, you got to stop this," Podesta wrote. "If we are going to be at each other's throats before we start, we are going nowhere." Raines took umbrage and wrote a long and sharp series of emails in which he offered to step away completely from the campaign. He'd never really be too far from Hillary, he knew, because she trusted him more than her new communications team. "She has a very tough job to do tomorrow," Podesta admonished his colleague, referring to the first news conference on the State Department emails. "Do you really think it helps get her in the right headspace to tell her she can't trust anyone she just brought on board? Why are you fanning this with her? In addition to the dissonant chorus within the as-yet-unlaunched campaign, Hillary maintained a network of donors, friends, allies, and advisors who could circumvent the official channels and plant ideas, good and bad, in her head. Often they went through Aberdeen, but some had a direct line to Hillary. One set had formed a semi-official senior advisors panel years earlier to help plan her post-State Department career. Podesta, Mills, and Sullivan were part of that group of straight shooters, which also included Hillary's White House Chief of Staff Maggie Williams, Bill's White House Political Director Mignon Moore, News Corp Executive Jim Kennedy, Hillary's State Department Protocol Chief Capricia Marshall, and Roy Spence, the branding genius who had marketed the famous Don't Mess with Texas anti-litter campaign in the Lone Star State. Originally, they had advised her on the logistics of undertaking projects, like working at the Clinton Foundation and giving paid speeches, that they thought would suit her and leave open the option of running for president. The basic mandate was proceed with ideas that would work either way, said one of the senior advisors. The approval of speeches to Wall Street banks and her work at the foundation would later prove to be missteps. There was a certain duality to Hillary's vast political empire. While it was true that most of the voices inside and outside the campaign had something valuable to contribute, when taken together, they were cacophonous. Rarely did everyone agree on a particular course of action, and often the counsel Hillary got came with the baggage of the advisor's agenda in maintaining good relations with the candidate or trying to make a rival look bad. Both Palmieri, a Podesta protege, and Benenson were hired in part because Hillary knew she had to signal to donors, Democratic officials, and the party's voters that she'd learned to open up her tightly knit circle to new perspectives and replicate the no-drama approach that had served Obama's campaign so well in 2008. And yet, the whole structure of the campaign, with chieftains but no clear leader, was a recipe for the kind of creative and sometimes explosive tension that had characterized Bill Clinton's second term in the White House and Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign. In addition, the people close to Clinton didn't know politics, and the political pros she'd hired didn't know her very well. That compelled her most trusted aides to try to prove themselves in the political arena, and the campaign trail veterans to jockey to get closer to her. Everyone was throwing elbows, and it was happening before she'd even made the campaign official. Schwerin, the chief speechwriter, found himself at the center of all that distress as he tried to fashion her first big address, which would take place not in Iowa, but on Roosevelt Island, a narrow strip of land in the East River named after FDR. She would speak from Four Freedoms Park, a monument to his legendary 1941 speech to Congress. The venue was Hillary's preferred location for kicking off the campaign, and she hoped to deliver a speech there that would echo through history like Roosevelt's. If she won the presidency, her remarks would be seen as an important historical marker. It's hard to turn the numbingly mundane details of statecraft into winning politics. But that's the charge Hillary handed Schwerin, who had been a press assistant in her Senate office, a speechwriter in her State Department, and the ghostwriter of her post-state memoir. He was a well-liked fixture within the small but influential State Department clique that transitioned into top jobs on her presidential campaign. With neatly kept facial hair that made him look just a few years more mature than his actual age, Schwerin struggled from the start to write anything that could pass muster with Benenson and Palmieri. After years at Hillary's side, he was accustomed to working directly with her. But in the new campaign's power structure, He had to go through the consultants and the communications director to get to her. Schwerin's personal relationships with Hillary, Abedin, and Sullivan protected him, but some of the others on the campaign thought that he was in over his head. About a month before Hillary's big launch, he asked colleagues on the campaign to recruit a star wordsmith for help. Benenson and Margolis reached out to Jon Favreau, the vaunted speechwriter for Barack Obama, to help draft the kind of visionary message that had eluded Hillary in her first campaign for the presidency. Favreau, then 33, had seen a lot in his short life as a political operative. He had helped navigate Obama through the famous race speech in Philadelphia in 2008, the first inaugural address ever given by a person of color, and several reports to Congress on the State of the Union. By putting words in the mouth of a politician with a unique gift for giving wings to oratory, Favreau had ascended to an elite rung of political speechwriters by the time he arrived at the White House in 2009. His natural writing skills were bolstered by a meticulous work ethic and years of serving an exciting boss with oratorical flair. After speaking to Obama about speeches on a more philosophical level, and then boiling the prose down to story form, he would hole up in his basement-level White House office for weeks at a time before major addresses. Then he would sit beside the president on one of the biscuit-colored couches in the Oval Office as his boss used a red pen to perfect his work. Favreau once told the New York Times that writing for the word-conscious Obama was like serving as Ted Williams's batting coach. Now he was being asked to perform a similar feat for a candidate who lacked the splendid splinter's vision. Ultimately, the recruitment of Favreau would serve as the harbinger of a bizarre and bizarre-like speechwriting process. It would have been enough of a challenge for him to channel Hillary after working so closely with Obama for so many years. But there was a wrinkle. Favreau wasn't being asked to write the speech himself. He would just be assisting Schwerin, the campaign's primary speechwriter, who was also collecting ideas from an array of former Clinton advisors and new bandwagon hoppers. Even the Ringer had to work through a committee. Once Favreau came on board, he was paired with longtime Clinton speechwriter Lissa Muscatine to put some extra punch into the speech, by then scheduled for June 13th. They both knew how to put words in someone else's mouth. They understood the essence and curves of great oratory, how to connect the memorable one-liners with the true substance of an argument, how to twine the speaker with her narrative, and how to talk into history. It was Muscatine who had written Clinton's landmark speech to a Beijing women's conference in 1995, with its signature line, "Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights." Muscatine knew Hillary's voice as well as Hillary did. These two high-end scriveners of different ages and different perspectives but similar talent actually found that they really liked working with each other. Muscatine was impressed with Favreau's skill and his deference. After all, the guy had all the reason in the world to be an arrogant prick. His words had already helped elect a president twice. But if he saw himself as above writing for Hillary, he never let on. And Favreau was fascinated with Muscatine's feel for Clinton's leanings and rhythms, her personal history, and the history she hoped to make. Plus, he wanted Hillary to win. Like Margolis and Benenson, with whom he'd worked on Obama's campaigns, Favreau saw her as the best chance to cement and extend Obama's legacy. On the surface, the writing pair was a microcosm of a campaign operation that sought to join the Clinton and Obama wings of the Democratic Party, mix baby boomers with millennials, and open up the famously insular Hillary land to fresh voices and ideas. It was clear, even then, that she could distance herself only so far from Obama, and that there were elements of his presidency she would want to exalt. But Hillary still struggled with the question of whether she was running for Bill Clinton's third term, Obama's third term, or her own first term. How do you take credit for 8 years of Democratic progress, but also get that things haven't gone far enough? Said one aide, who wrestled with the conundrum. She hired all of us to help her figure this out, and I think at the beginning we struggled to do that. That confusion was reflected in the conclusion that Favreau and Muscatine both reached early on. The campaign was an unholy mess, fraught with tangled lines of authority, petty jealousies, distorted priorities, and no sense of greater purpose. No one was in charge, and no one had figured out how to make the campaign about something bigger than Hillary. Muscatine felt that the speech said nothing because it tried to say too much. Favreau thought Clinton's campaign was reminiscent of John Kerry's, where he had gotten his start in 2004, a bunch of operatives who were smart and accomplished in their own right, but weren't united by any common purpose larger than pushing a less than thrilling candidate into the White House. Hillary didn't have a vision to articulate, and no one else could give one to her. In fact, the more people she assigned to the task of setting the tone for her campaign, the more muddled her message became. The list of writers on the first address included, but was not limited to, Schwerin, Muscatine, Favreau, Benenson, Mook, Palmieri, Podesta, Grunwald, Sullivan, and Shockey, who was Michelle Obama's image maven before joining the Clinton campaign. On one eye-rollingly mundane conference call with her speechwriting team early in the process, Hillary talked about what she wanted from the exercise. Though she was speaking with a small group made up mostly of intimates, she sounded like she was addressing a room full of supporters, inhibited by the concern that whatever she said might be leaked to the press. Her marching orders were to find a slogan and a message. The absence of any talk about her actual vision for the country or the reasons voters should choose her stunned some of the participants. There was never any question, and no advisor prompted discussion of "Why you? Why now?" one of them recalled. From the earliest planning stages of the campaign, Hillary's advisors had debated the extent to which she should correct for her 2008 loss by more overtly running as a woman. "I think running on her gender would be the same mistake as 2008, i.e. having a message at odds with what voters ultimately want," Mook had written to Mills. "Lots of people are going to say it would be neat for a woman to be president, but that doesn't mean that's actually why they will vote for her. It's also risky because injecting gender makes her candidacy about her and not the voters and making their lives better." That sensitivity would factor into her decision not to overemphasize Eleanor Roosevelt, a fellow first lady, in her speech. But other advisors, and ultimately Hillary, felt that gender was an important facet of her narrative. A favored approach was to place her in a lineage of women in her family, starting with her late mother, Dorothy Rodham, and running through to her granddaughter, Charlotte. As the day of the speech drew closer, Dorothy's story of personal hardship took on a more prominent role because of a desire to better illuminate Hillary's motivation, Schwerin explained to colleagues. And yet, as the drafts rolled in, Favreau and Muscatine realized that while there were a lot of shout-outs to particular constituencies, there was little in the way of an overarching definition of the candidate. Schwerin struggled to take all the input and wrangle it into a Hillary narrative. Meanwhile, Favreau and Muscatine decided to draft their own version, which, according to one source, ran into the buzzsaw of internal dynamics, the same bureaucracy that hampered Schwerin. The speechwriting process was the first time when everyone was pulling it out on the table and measuring up, said one Hillary advisor. Right out of the gate, there was nothing quite like the aimlessness and dysfunction of Hillary Clinton's second campaign for the presidency, except maybe those of her first bid for the White House. From this process, nothing could emerge alive. In early June, Palmieri told Podesta and Margolis she'd make sure the speech turned out right. "I'm taking the reins," she said. But she couldn't just swipe Schwerin's pen. If she undercut him and outsourced his job, she risked making an enemy out of a protected citizen of Hillary land. Though some of Hillary's aides were both competent and loyal, the candidate favored the latter over the former, which is one major reason the campaign's gears often got stuck. "There's one goal here, to win the fucking election for president," said one source familiar with the speech-writing process. "It's like, do you want to win the goddamn thing, or are we in junior high school again?" Palmieri's dilemma crystallized the way the convoluted power structure encouraged the denizens of Hillary land to care more about their standing with her or their future job opportunities than getting her elected. For all of her autopsies, Hillary's management style hadn't really changed since the 2008 campaign. "Dan Schwerin isn't the issue," said one of Hillary's top aides. "It's the candidate herself." Frustrated with the process and the product, Favreau dropped out about a week before Clinton stepped to the podium. As a parting shot, he delivered to Benenson and Palmieri a frank assessment of the shortcomings of the operation and the speech. It was coming in way too long, lacked a central rationale for why Hillary was running for president, and sounded enough like standard Democratic pablum that, with the exception of the biographical details, it could have been delivered by anyone in the party. Beyond that, it was the product of a write-by-committee paradigm that never would have passed muster in either of the Obama campaigns. There was no strong leader running the show. Around that time, Hillary decided to give Schwerin a direct line to her without interference from his internal and external critics. "Dan and I are going to finish this speech," she told her team. "Back off." During the last 48 hours before the speech, she and Bill went through draft after draft, shipping edits to Schwerin. She didn't like the text yet, and neither did Bill, who tried his best to add some poetry, the buzzy Bill Clintonisms that frame an idea. Said one advisor, "It changed from the last time our eyes were on it, and when she's up there. And that only means one thing, WJC, baby." But the basic frailty remained what Favreau had pointed out, the failure of the speech to connect Hillary to a cause larger than herself. And no one could change that, not even Bill Clinton. In the wee hours of the morning on the day of the kickoff rally, Hillary was still looking at a Frankenstein's monster of a speech. It wouldn't get much better for the changes Schwerin tapped out from the tramway platform before closing his laptop and riding to Roosevelt Island. And so, under a blistering sun on a hot Saturday in mid-June, with a glare so bright she struggled to see the speech on the teleprompter in front of her, Hillary Clinton whimpered her way into the election. Reporters immediately noticed that an overflow area set up with massive TV screens was empty. While Hillary surrounded herself with supporters in images broadcast across the nation, the crowd was remarkably small, given that the event was held in a city of more than 8 million people, in a state she had represented in the Senate. The speech started as an acknowledgement of political icons, Roosevelt, Obama, and Bill Clinton, and mixed in applause lines for constituencies Hillary wanted to court, including African Americans, Hispanics, the LGBT community, and women of all races and sexual orientations. She sprinkled in bromides about economic opportunity and how prosperity can't just be for CEOs. But there was no overarching narrative explaining her candidacy, No framing of Hillary as the point of an underdog spear. No emotive power. America can't succeed unless you succeed, she offered in a trite tautology. That is why I am running for president of the United States. Even those in her camp who defended the speech acknowledged that there were too many cooks in the kitchen, that the text was too watered down to serve as a call to action, and that Hillary was less than inspiring. And these were the kinder criticisms. That speech had a simple mission, which was a requirement, said one source close to Hillary. This was the chance to make a credible, persuasive case for why she wants to be president. She had to answer the why question. It's not because of her mother. Her mother's an inspiration, but that is not why. It has to sort of feel like kind of a call to action, a galvanizing, I'm bringing us together around this larger-than-all-of-us idea or cause, and I don't think it did that. I don't think it did either of those. Some of Hillary's aides longed for her to find her own David Axelrod, someone who could really help her articulate a vision and stay on message. From the earliest days of the campaign, many of Hillary's closest friends discussed how to push Mook out, or down, to make room for someone with a better understanding of the candidate and a better ear for the more populist mood of the electorate. Mook appeared to be running a less dramatic version of Hillary's 2008 campaign, but that was in large part because he preferred to avoid airing problems internally and because Hillary had made clear that leaking would not be tolerated. She had built a team almost designed to feud, and she personally went around her own aides to task outsiders with assignments. To the extent that lines of authority existed, they were blurred. That first speech reflected a lot of what would come afterward, said one person involved in the process. The infighting still raged as it had 7 years before. But acts of aggression were executed passively, and the disputes didn't make it into cable news broadcasts. All of the jockeying might have been all right, but for a root problem that confounded everyone on the campaign and outside it. Hillary had been running for president for almost a decade and still didn't really have a rationale. I would have had a reason for running, one of her top aides said, or I wouldn't have run. Chapter 2. The Mercenaries and the Missionaries. The surest sign that the young man Hillary Clinton tapped to run her 2016 campaign was a power player savvy beyond his years came in late 2010. Robbie Mook was a boyish 30 then, a rising star among Democratic operatives. He'd been beckoned from Las Vegas for a dinner with New York Representative Steve Israel, the incoming chairman of the committee charged with electing House Democrats in the wake of a historic midterm loss of congressional seats. Israel wanted Mook to run the day-to-day operations of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and he pressed the young man on what they should do first to set up for the 2012 elections in 2 years. Unflinching, Mook responded with the words of a professional political assassin. Clean house, he said. It was a classic high-end Washington power move. Fire everyone. Force people to reapply for their jobs. Those who remain know to whom they owe their allegiance. And use the new openings to bring in loyalists. That Mook wanted to burn down the DCCC and rebuild it in his image wasn't a unique instinct. That he was playing Beltway power games this astutely so soon in life marked him as a much higher level operative than the vast majority of his contemporaries, and most party elders, for that matter. By early 2014, when Hillary was beginning to think seriously about how she would put together a campaign for 2016, Mook was perfectly positioned to run the preliminary process. He'd just come off managing the campaign of one of Hillary's closest allies, longtime Clinton money man Terry McAuliffe for the governorship of Virginia in November 2013. Mook won acclaim within Democratic circles for getting McAuliffe across the finish line, even though the margin of victory ended up being much smaller than Democrats had expected heading into Election Day. He was a free agent and a hot commodity at a time when most operatives, including Guy Cecil, the political director of Hillary's 2008 campaign and a frequent mention for campaign manager during the run-up to her 2016 bid, were ensconced in guiding midterm House and Senate election efforts. On the first day of April in 2014, long before Hillary would publicly acknowledge that she was gearing up to run, Mook emailed Podesta and Hillary consigliere Cheryl Mills, who were expected to take on the roles of campaign co-chairs, to present a series of options for how Hillary could get the ball rolling. "I was frankly surprised yesterday by her openness to starting a PAC, etc.," Mook wrote. "For that reason, my recommendation here is to open an exploratory committee. It has advantages over a PAC, and I think they're the same in the eyes of the media." Importantly, he added, "I assumed for all scenarios that nothing happens before the midterms." Mills quickly agreed with his plan for a post-midterm exploratory committee. Mook was already operating inside a framework first developed for Hillary by David Plouffe, President Barack Obama's longtime strategist, who had put together a preliminary memo for Hillary in December 2013. As Obama's campaign manager in 2008, Plouffe had despised Clinton. That he was now advising her was an important signal of just how completely she would co-opt the Democratic establishment, even before she began running. Plouffe had no love for Hillary, but he was a loyal Democrat and had determined early on that he wanted to build on Obama's legacy. He was also an influential advocate for Mook. By sending the memo, Plouffe was trying to force some action on Clinton's part, said a source who spoke with him at the time. He was concerned they were squandering the advantage they had in terms of prep time. With the assistance of two others, he wrote, "A blueprint for how you might launch a campaign," the source said. In a private exchange with Podesta that winter, Plouffe emphasized that it was important to have the right culture and mission, to manage Bill Clinton, and to effectively target Latino voters. On the first point, Mook fit the right mold for a campaign manager, or at least he seemed to. He had a reputation for running loyal operations with little drama and even fewer unauthorized leaks to the press. Mook also displayed some characteristics that, for better and worse, aligned with Hillary's own traits. He wanted all of the available data at his fingertips before he made a decision, and tended strongly toward the option with the most hard evidence behind it. "He's just extremely rigorous," said one Mook ally on the campaign staff, "testing and retesting and digging in on everything. It drives people crazy in a healthy way and forces them to think through every angle of something." Mook's attention to data and evidence allowed him to justify his decision-making to Hillary in a language she respected. It was the way in which he was most like her. Mook wasn't the only candidate for the campaign manager's job. Five Democratic operatives were seriously considered, but he used his advantage as the first person in the door to get closer to Hillary and prove his utility to her. Over the course of 2014, even as he supplied Hillary with the names of other possibilities to run the campaign or assume high-ranking roles, Mook emerged as the natural choice to take the job. By the time Hillary drew up a short list of finalists late that year, he was already the prohibitive favorite. Yet for all Mook's advantages, including having the support of Plouffe and the uber-influential McAuliffe, his newness to a senior role in Clinton world would create tremendous hurdles for him as he tried to wrangle what was sure to be a sprawling campaign. He had worked for her in 2008 as a state director, but he would never be close to Hillary like Abedin, who had been at her elbow for nearly two decades, or Sullivan, who had traveled with her to more than 100 countries during their years together at State. The Clinton orbit included so many longtime friends and advisors, so many planet-sized satellites, that a newcomer like Mook could never be fully in control of it. Robbie had a structural issue that he just had to deal with, and there were certain areas that weren't really going to be his, one Hillary ally explained, before listing some of the topics outside Mook's authority: emails, the foundation, speeches, candidate time, policy. After the 2014 midterms, when Democrats got walloped across the country and Republicans took control of the Senate, Mook grew anxious to move Hillary forward into the race. In the hours after the defeat, he dashed off an email to Podesta and Mills. The party was about to descend into chaos, he worried. The circular firing squads will unleash tomorrow, and there will be a smorgasbord of overinterpretations, he wrote. I'm already hearing the modeling people say that TV doesn't work, and the TV people saying analytics doesn't work. And I'm sure someone tomorrow will say campaigning on women's issues doesn't work. It all still works, and the dynamics of 16 will be completely different. I would be way more prospective than retrospective. Mook worried that an anti-Hillary candidate would gain traction while voters wondered about the fire in her belly. If she's slow to get in, he thought, people will think she doesn't want it enough, that she's not hungry enough. Plus, there was a golden opportunity for Hillary to take control of the party and put her stamp on it at a time when Obama's brand had been scraped by the shoals of a low turnout election. She could be a rescuer, a savior of the Democratic Party. Hillary was in much less of a rush. She'd been amassing a fortune giving paid speeches to private companies, including Wall Street banks, and she didn't see the need to prolong what would be a grueling campaign. She even told friends and advisors that she was reluctant about jumping in at all. She didn't want to run for president, one person she spoke to at the time said. She did not want to do it. She just concluded that no one else could win. This may have sounded like the idea of running was thrust upon her by circumstance, but in truth, she had spent the years since her 2008 primary defeat building herself and her operation in anticipation of a possible second bid. The real question wasn't whether she would begin campaigning, but whether she would stop. The process for making a final decision would run for more than a year, with Hillary trying to understand all of the angles. She needed to get a better feel for fundraising in an internet age, how Supreme Court rulings on campaign finance would affect her, where a party apparatus long neglected by Obama stood, and how voter targeting, analytics, and social media would factor into a winning candidate's plans. In a way, her process was the logical extension of the conversation she'd been having with her closest confidants since 2008. Hillary was still absorbing information as Mook pressed her to start giving more definitive indications that she was running and begin spending money on building the actual campaign. He presented her with three options for how to transition from a non-candidate to a candidate in waiting. The first alternative, which included the formation of an exploratory committee and an earliest possible launch date, was the one he favored. Even as he pointed Hillary toward a campaign, some of her closest and longest tenured allies, most notably Mills, advised against it. But by late 2014, Mook was given the green light to begin convening meetings with potential staff and advisors. He held them in a nondescript Washington law office with the Democratic Party's new guard of elections experts, including Obama campaign veterans Mitch Stewart and Jen O'Malley Dillon. Hillary met with O'Malley Dillon, too. Even though she had given Mook an inside track, Hillary didn't want to eliminate good options. Like Emily's List president, Stephanie Shriok, who had been in the mix earlier, O'Malley Dillon came with a track record that no candidate could afford to ignore in trying to pick the right campaign manager. Strawberry blonde and bespectacled, she had served as the deputy campaign manager for operations on Obama's re-election team and as his battleground state's director in 2008. Mook had a reputation for being a field organizer. O'Malley Dillon had much more real-world experience in that realm. She'd worked to turn out voters at every level, from state legislative races to several prior presidential campaigns, and Hillary wanted to get to know her better. Their meeting took place on a busy December day for Hillary, who also had Senator Elizabeth Warren, a progressive favorite, on her schedule. But she cleared about 90 minutes to assess O'Malley Dillon. As they sat down in the living room of the Clintons' brick colonial on Whitehaven Street, amid pictures of family members and a pantheon of international celebrities, Hillary kicked her feet up onto the coffee table. The two women had never spoken to each other before, but the gesture put O'Malley Dillon at ease as Hillary began probing to find out what kind of campaign manager her interviewee would be. How would you build the infrastructure of the campaign? What would your organizational chart look like? How would you shape the message? Where would data and digital operations fit into your plan? O'Malley Dillon explained how the Obama campaigns had operated, how state organizations could be built, where elected officials could be counted on to deliver their own constituents to the polls, and where Hillary would have to create infrastructure to turn out voters. Hillary began to home in on one line of inquiry. Do I have to build a big national footprint? Or can I rely on the Democratic National Committee, state parties, and outside groups to shoulder some of the burden? She wanted to get a sense of whether O'Malley Dillon was a big spender. Mook knew that Hillary viewed almost every early decision through a 2008 lens. She thought almost everything her own campaign had done was flawed, and almost everything Obama's had done was pristine. Hillary felt that profligate spending was one major cause of her undoing. The money needs to be tightly managed,